Welcome to the M&A Zing, the podcast for acquisition entrepreneurs, search funders, and holdco builders across the UK and Europe. In this buy-side breakdown segment, we roll up our sleeves on real, live SMB listings, unpacking the numbers, surfacing hidden risks, and hunting for the upside. Whether you're lining up your very first offer or adding to the next bolt-on for a growing holdco, pull up a chair. This is where we stress test opportunities and turn listings into lessons. I am joined, as ever, by my captivating co-host, Gareth Hawkins, CEO of BizCrunch and Serial Acquirer. How are you, Gareth?
Good, thank you. I'm flattered. I'm not sure I'm that captivating, but you're very kind. And how are you keeping this week, Alfie?
I'm very well. Well, we went for effervescent last time, so I'm going to give you a different compliment every episode.
Keeping my toes, different adjectives.
But yes, I'm doing very well, thank you. I'm excited for another buy-side breakdown. Last time we did it was our first episode, obviously, and it went really well. People seem to really enjoy it, so I'm excited for episode two.
Had some lovely messages actually through LinkedIn and the likes from long time listener, first time caller, who were quite keen on the change of format. So yeah, let's see if we can keep a streak going.
Absolutely. Well, before we dive into that, Gareth, can you kick us off with the news?
Yeah, sure. Well, another busy week. Seems to all be happening in Spain at the moment. So here's three news items about Spain that we'll run through. But Targus Capital, which is a Spanish search fund led by Diego Canales Delgado and Nicolas Romo Portal, have closed their search phase. And their cap table is pretty impressive. You've got JB46, Colca Capital, Ithaca. You've got Cabieza Capital, Sequoias, Ventus Capital Partners, and a large number of high net worth individuals that have participated. So really nice to see Targus, another Spanish search fund, getting off the ground. Lots to go at. Their thesis takes them all the way across Southern Europe. So looking forward to hear which deals they take down over the next year or so.
Congratulations, Targus. Well, my news is also from Spain. So Lauria Partners, who are a Spanish aerospace and defense-focused search fund, have acquired Gutzmar, who are a precision machining company based in Barcelona, which sounds to me a lot like a vertical acquisition of a key supplier.
Yeah, I think from looking at it, Gutzmar do quite a lot in the defense space. So yeah, very sensible to secure that supply chain, I think, given where the world has unfortunately been heading.
Yes. The less said on that, the better.
Yes, quite. Afraid so.
Any more news?
Yes, sorry. going off on a little wistful lament about global politics. Yeah, okay, come back to message here. Yeah, there definitely is. Something that's kept me interested this week is reading the latest edition of Search Fund Squared from Moonbase Capital. It's a nice series. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. But this time they focused on Konstantin Marek and Mikkel Kaminski of Lynx Trail Capital, who are one of the leading pioneering search funds in Poland. Some really interesting stuff in their profile there. I'd recommend it to the listeners. Light reading.
Very interesting. Yeah, we'll share the link. I actually haven't read any of the Search Fund Squared series, so I'll have to do some catching up.
Yeah, Moonbase are obviously a good authority on this. They've invested in quite a lot. They've been really improving accessibility of search funds to investors. And you know, their commentary on certain funds that either they have backed or that they've been looking at has been quite enlightening. So yeah, good series. Keep it up, please, Moonbase.
Absolutely. Okay, well, that is our news segment concluded. Let's get into this week's buy-side breakdown. So this week, we're looking at a group of three freehold nurseries in the northwest of England.
Exciting nurseries. Yeah. In a previous conversation, I think, with Charlie Norton, we were talking about how becoming new parents and putting your kids in nurseries makes you look at them very differently with a private equity eye, and you can sort of see the attraction. But it's been a really busy space, actually, nursery roll-ups over the last sort of decade. There are some OGs in this space that have got prolific portfolios now.
Yeah, I was really surprised, actually. We were talking about there's a list of the 25 largest nursery chains in the UK. So topping that out is Busy Bees with 366 nurseries across the country.
Busy Bees have been busy bees buying up all of these sites. But they've had a slew of different private equity owners over the sort of last couple of decades.
But there are, you know, 10, 15 groups in the UK with sort of 50 plus nurseries under their belt, which is really impressive to me. Sort of going in the same direction that sort of veterinary centres did a decade ago, I guess.
Exactly that. And I think whilst, you know, there is an element of dependency on kind of some of the government funding whims around this. Yeah. And obviously 2024, there was a change in policy to create more government funding entitlement for the parents with younger children. Mm-hmm. It has kind of been a bit of a catalyst, I think, for the space, given it a new lease of life. You've seen a number of additional deals being done recently. I know Kindred Nurseries, who were invested in by Living Bridge, one of the private equity firms recently, they've been very acquisitive. I think they're going from something like 40 sites to 150 sites, so they've been very bold. You've got Kids Planet, who are, I guess, up there in that top five.
Yeah.
What do they own? Something like 150-200 sites now.
172.
There you are. Okay, so yeah, they're owned by Fremen Capital and Suter Investments, and again, you know, it's all go for growth. You've got Bright Stars, which was obviously a product of Innovation Capital Partners, recently bought by Oakley Capital. They just keep on growing. Bright Stars have got, hundreds of sites now. So
yeah,
it's an interesting space. Grandier, the sort of French firm, I think it is, the global acquirer of nurseries. I think they've got Infravia as being their owner. They've been very acquisitive in recent years in the UK. So, it's a great space. I'm sure a company like we're going to review now, with three sites, you know, nice, you know, part of the country, with some decent freehold, are going to be in hot demand. So let's get into the fundamentals, shall we? We've obviously pulled some of their data from BizCrunch, having found this particular listing originally on, is it Business Buyers? Who's the agent? Who's the broker here?
Businessbuyers.co.uk.
Yeah, is it one of their affiliated entities is it Redwoods?
Yes, Redwoods down in Kerr, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So they are specialists in this space. They do education and medical, I think, brokering for business buyers. But so let's dig into the listing, shall we? What have we got?
So off the bat, we have no listed asking price, a turnover of 1.263 million and adjusted EBITDA of 284k. Capacity for 320 children. All three nurseries awarded good by Ofsted, and reason for sale is a retiring vendor.
Aha, the retiring owner again. Yes, common thing we're coming up against, and certainly a lot of that in this space. I was looking at nurseries for a client the other day, and there's a slew of them where the owners are sort of north of retirement. So, yeah, that's really interesting. So what do we know about the asset value that isn't disclosed necessarily on the listing? But what is the background on this? We think we've identified who this company is, right?
Yes, we're fairly sure, but that does raise some questions. So obviously this is listed as, in the description it says, the nurseries operate from three freehold properties with expansive outdoor space and facilities. But we had some discussion back and forth whether this listing includes those properties or whether they are separate.
Yeah, I know on Redwood's website, they actually list this as Manchester, whereas on Business Buyers, they list it as Northwest. So if we assume that one of those sites is in Manchester?
Yes. Well, from the digging that we've done and the nursery chain that we believe that it is, it looks like it kind of tarries up with their three locations, one in the heart of Manchester, one just outside in a kind of sort of border suburb, and then one a town a little further out, all almost sort of on the same train line out to Southwest Manchester, which is interesting. So sort of going past the airport and the hospitals out there, which would make
affluent
it perfect.
Areas, would you say? Or
yeah, I would say so. I would say that, you know, probably up and coming areas. I think it looks like one's in Withenshaw, which is sort of on the edge of Stockport and is on the way up. And Hartford is a lovely sort of suburban area, sort of out in the Crewe direction. So very useful for commuters as well.
Have they arrived enough to each have a Gales bakery in there?
I'm not sure. I haven't spent enough time in those places.
Is it a Gales or is it a Greggs? I mean, which one are we talking here?
Yeah, Gales or Greggs is the yardstick of gentrification, isn't it? So probably Greggs, but a Gales on the way, I would say.
Oh, nice. Okay, so there's a potential upside there in terms of changing demographic.
Yeah, well, I mean, like Manchester has seen a massive influx in people moving up from the south. And I think what I've noticed since I've been here, because I am one of those people, sorry, Manchester residents, what I've noticed quite a lot is people tend to come and live here, and they tend to live in the centre and right on the edge of the city for the first year or so. And then they sort of graduate out into the smaller commuter towns because the public transport here is great. So we're starting to see, you know, areas like Withenshaw that's right on the edge, or even further out in Hertford, if people wanted to live on a train line but have a bit more of a countryside feel, they're starting to get more and more of that kind of drip feed of commuters and, you know, Manchester new residents. So gentrification follows.
Great. So what kind of properties do we feel these might be like? If they're freehold, are we talking sort of like retail shopfront locations? Are we talking like porter cabins, or what are we talking? Where on the spectrum might these be?
Well, I mean, for the central Manchester location, again, if this is the nursery that we believe that it is, it's right next to Manchester Oxford Road station. So it's very much high rise buildings around there. So I'd be surprised. I'd be really interested to see what they have in terms of outside space in such a busy area. Very popular with students, lots of student accommodation. Yeah, so that one would be super busy. I think if you were out in kind of Hertford and even the Withenshaw, I think they'd have a bit more space there. I think they're probably a little bit more upmarket than a porter cabin. But yeah, this does kind of bring us back to that asset value, because from what we've seen, I'd be surprised if the asset value listed for that company would cover three locations, including one in central Manchester. I could be wrong.
I was thinking the same, actually. So from our analysis looks like it's sort of what 450 grand's worth of assets.
So
you'd be hard pushed to get all of the fit out and the three sites onto that balance sheet, I think, unless you were talking porter cabins, but that's very unlikely in those locations. I note though that the one of the directors and PSCs actually also owns a PropCo separately.
Yes, and what I'm thinking maybe is at least one of these locations might be part of that PropCo. If I was to hazard a guess, I would guess potentially the city centre location, and then the other two are part of the nursery.
But, yeah, because there's another 370k worth of assets in that PropCo. So collectively, we're talking 800k, which might get you three sort of small sites for this number of kids, 300 kids, right?
Yeah, I think 800k would cover it. For those sites, 350 kids, yeah. About 100 or so at each. I think the 800 would cover it. So it's most likely that those are broken up between those two.
So what kind of a deal gets done here? I guess if it's freehold, you've got the property deal being done alongside the operating EBITDA multiple piece, which from a financing perspective is pretty interesting, because if you lent it more towards the former, you get slightly, you'll get commercial mortgage terms on acquiring this. But what kind of multiple do we think gets paid for a nursery of this, or a nursery group of this size?
That's a great question. I mean, I'd probably wager in the sort of 2.5 to 3.5x range.
So fairly typical, fairly standard. I guess what limits this possibly is capacity. So like if it's 350 kids capacity currently, what's the utilization of that capacity, and what could be done to increase the yield that you'd get from each of these sites? I note that they mentioned in their accounts they've got 42 members of staff. I guess there's going to be some shift work element to all of that, but what can be done if you were to buy this? How much growth could you actually drive, and how would you go about driving that growth, I guess, is the question, because that's going to influence what an acquirer would be willing to pay as a multiple in terms of do I get my money back, and if so, how quickly, and growth will accelerate.
Yes, and look, unused heads on registration is where you're going to make your money. Capacity is currency when it comes to a business like this. They have spoken about room to expand, but I would like to know if that's imagined room to expand, or whether there's planning permission for that, or, you know, how set is that? Is it just that they have some room that you could put some additional space onto? How far along in that process are they? Because yeah, that's really where the growth comes from. I mean, look, we talk about changing demographics, and that's something that I would dig into if I was to go deeper down the rabbit hole in this business. You know, look at where they are, look at what the changes are. Could there be increases in prices there? But really, you are always going to be limited by the number of heads that you can fit in, unless there are, you know, possibilities for expansion into additional hours, you know, potentially sort of holiday clubs and things like that. But yeah, that's really where the limiting factor comes in. So I'd love to know what they mean by, you know, room to grow.
Yeah, likewise. And what kind of capex is required in order to drive that expansion? Because you've got a whole other ROI question then around. It's not, you know, you're not just got the ROI of when I'm going to get the initial acquisition capital back from the operations, but if I'm going to expand the operations, and that's going to require me to put some capex in, and possibly I might be already, you know, heavily leveraged in the deal structure that I end up doing in acquiring it. Like, well, how many years will I wait to get my money back for my expansion? So, delicate consideration, lots of calculation required, but it, as you say, it's going to be planning permission driven. There's a staffing challenge if you're going to increase the capacity. Obviously, there's a statutory maximum number of kids you can have per key carer. So that's something that's always worth thinking about. And of course, you know, with an army of people in these sort of businesses comes additional overhead in managing those people and, you know, HR, et cetera, as well. So I wonder, in a sort of, I hate the way that this is used in private equity for nursery rollouts, but revenue per child, which makes it sound a bit of a commodity.
Doesn't sound great, does it? No.
As a parent, I'm not sure I want my child to be assessed on revenue. I wonder what that metric looks like in these kinds of locations, whether there is a premium and a good margin to be made on all the kind of costs to serve, or whether it is, you know, sort of a subsisting kind of exercise, and you don't end up doing it for the money, you end up doing it for the mission, the social mm-hmm. impact, if you will.
Yes, I mean, we obviously, there is money to be made in this business, otherwise, you know, those numbers and those companies that we reeled off at the start of this call wouldn't exist. But then this was a question that I was going to put to you. I mean, is this something that someone should go into without prior knowledge? I mean, is it something that you can pick up and run with? And they talk about the fact they've got an experienced staff and it could all be hands off. But, you know, things like, you know, regulations and Ofsted and, you know, the way that government influence affects it. Like, is this something that you'd really want to know going in order to make the most of this? Is this something that a sector agnostic person could pick up and run with?
I'd find that difficult to believe. I think it's one of those regulated spaces with Ofsted that, you know, there are certain qualifications and accreditations, etc., that both the sites and the leadership would be expected to have. So, I mean, if they're all covered off and, you know, the team that's there is the compliance, the sort of governance piece that's required, then yes, ostensibly. But obviously, don't want to dig up the past, but there are some examples, if you like, in acquisition entrepreneurship where nurseries were acquired by people that weren't specialists in this space and didn't end well.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it can be done if there's good management, but I don't think it's the sort of thing you could just set and forget and, like, you know, come back once a quarter for a board meeting. I feel like it's the sort of thing that morally you're compelled to keep your hand on the tiller.
Well, and I also think, well, yeah, absolutely morally. I think also, you know, going back to what we were saying about Ofsted, the fact that they have good Ofsted ratings across all three locations, I think is an excellent thing, because that shows that's not a fluke. That shows good management. It shows that they've got a good team there and they know what they're doing.
But good is fairly generic, fairly mediocre, right? Because outstanding is the goal, which is tough to get and tough to keep. But note that this is not deemed, none of these sites are deemed outstanding. They're deemed good.
Yes. But if were someone to come along and lose the good rating on even one of those sites, I reckon that would nuke your EBITDA faster than a rent hike would. I think that
certainly kill your multiples.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, these things run on reputation. So, maybe it is one for those with a bit of prior knowledge. I mean, maybe not necessarily. Yeah, I think they're probably necessarily in the childcare space, actually. I think there are probably some transferable skills from some other sectors, but for me, I would be nervous to take on something like this.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. Assuming you couldn't, just say you couldn't in a short space of time increase the capacity for this business, mm-hmm. how else could you increase the revenue or profitability of this business? I mean, I wonder what the elasticity of pricing would be like in childcare. I mean, speaking as a parent that's paid through the nose to send his children to nursery in the past, it sometimes requires a full-time income just to pay the childcare in certain locations. What do you think is the feasibility of being able to get a price increase through on this kind of an asset?
I think it would be interesting to see where they're currently priced. I think one of the kind of nuances of the location is we are in a kind of flux in the Northwest where things are becoming more expensive because of people like me that have moved here. Again, sorry to all the Greater Manchester residents that hold me accountable for that. So it may be that they are priced to a kind of previously low number, and there could be some room for expansion there. But then you wouldn't want to, neglect the local community that maybe are still struggling to afford it as is. So there might be some room to grow there. I'm not sure. I think potentially if you can't increase the capacity, I think probably service diversification is the way to go. So like I said, maybe after school programs, holiday clubs, specialized classes, what else could you do with the space and increase maybe the hours rather than if you can't increase the capacity or the pricing?
Yeah, good point. Sweat the assets a bit more by using them for longer hours. Yeah, I see the merit of that. Also, are there sort of tiered strata in the market around different types of model here? Like, I get the thing that not everybody's charging the same price for the same product. There's a group called N Family Club that's it's growing quite rapidly down here in London, mm-hmm. where it's almost like putting your child into a Scandi styled kind of Nordic coffee shop experience with very curated programs of kind of Montessori-esque sort of experiences for these kids to kind of give them a head start, if you will, if your plan is to send them to Eton or something. these guys, N Family Club, charge significant premium versus like the sort of more generic competition. But they have little things like, as a parent, you can stay and co-work for a bit after you've dropped your kid off, or they'll provide you kind of coffee and croissants, which they call free, but I'm pretty sure given you paid through the nose for the fees, they're not really free. But the reason I asked about the affluence of the areas ultimately is because it is there a means to kind of pivot the model a bit and like take up market a nursery, or is a nursery just a nursery to the majority of people in these kind of places?
I mean, I think it would depend. I'm not too knowledgeable on Hertford or Withenshaw, I have to say. I do think it would be possible around the Manchester Oxford Road nursery, and maybe they could use that as a test site for that, because there are, we've had a huge influx of a lot of the challenger banks are based here now. So, your Starlings and your Monzos and such, and a lot of high paid tech workers in and around the city. I'm sure that something like what you've described might appeal to them. So maybe they could use that as a test site for something along those lines. If they do freehold the building in that location, then it would be a great place to kind of co-work from. that could be a consideration. It's do you have pricing tiers? Do we treat this like a SaaS model? I'd like my child on Platinum Plus, please.
Yeah, please send them out ready for prep school or whatever it will be.
That's super interesting. I mean, look, childcare is not something that I know much about, so that is really interesting. I can totally see that you could reposition yourself to be the kind of future leader trainer of babies.
Yeah. Basically in the fintech, we only do fintech kids. Yeah, I like that. Neobank customers only. But no, in all seriousness, like, there is always a risk, of course, when you change a model like that you would alienate your existing customer base before you are able to plug the gap with the higher end customers that you want to attract.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, this is another great point. So if someone were to take this on and the freehold of the properties is included, that does give you a good launch pad to provide capital for a fourth location, potentially. So if you were to want to try something new, that could be a way to do that. And that could be a way to expand capacity. They already have a, you know, reasonably well-known name in the area with the three sites. Would that be an option that you'd look at?
I think I most definitely would. In fact, they probably already have kind of centralized back office, like HR and IT and, you know, administration and that sort of stuff that maybe they're able to kind of amortize across a greater number of sites. And I think the more sites you build out, you know, from a common infrastructure, the more, you know, overall profitability you can drive because that of that, you know, deduplication piece, that shared central functions piece. So yeah, I think that's really inspired that actually this potentially becomes a bit of a platform. And I know actually within BizCrunch, we've got a couple of acquisition entrepreneurs that are actually actively looking about this now to find more platform companies in education. So yes, I think the growth here is not necessarily wring more out of the existing sites, except for wring more back office functions out of the HQ and can add on more sites using all of the kind of the learnings and the brand positioning and the systems and processes that you've got for three. Why couldn't you do that for six or nine or whatever over a period of a few years? So yeah, I think maybe that's the better use of capital in getting a foothold in other local markets around where the brand is considered strong.
Yeah, that makes sense. Going back to that, actually, we're talking about the back office stuff. One of the things that I thought was a positive from this listing is that they do have what seems to be a solid sort of back office team. And they do talk about it being sort of fairly management free. I don't think that's the exact term they use. Professional management in place, so kind of owner non-operational, which I think is great. And I think that for this particular industry, staff turnover can be high, and they do talk a lot about that they have good retention and good staff. I think that's a positive, and it would probably help you attract new staff. I would potentially, I think I read somewhere that they've got some members of staff that have been there for over 12 years, which I think is excellent. But I think 12-year veterans can come within this sort of invisible redundancy tab, so it'd be interesting to know that number. I think in a high turnover sort of space, taking on a business, being a new owner of a company with lots of long running staff might be a risk.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, look, it's a sort of exercise you go through with any acquisition is you look at those tenures, those length of services, you work out what your exposure liability would be. You know, every acquirer should be mindful of TUPE, transfer of undertaking, protection of employment. Yeah. So you can't really go in and make swinging cuts. You know, people are entitled to some continuity when you acquire the businesses.
Absolutely. But
similarly, you would quantify, you know, what if a redundancy process was necessary, where the total extent of your liabilities are, if there's anything contractual that entitles the staff to more than statutory redundancy, and, you know, then work out exactly what it would, say you wanted to cut 20% of your headcount, what actually would that look like in terms of the total cost liability to the business to pay them off and get them gone? Not something you necessarily ever really want to have to do, but you have to have a contingency plan, you know, plan for the, hope for the best, plan for the worst, I think, isn't it, Miso?
I think that's the saying. Is there anything in particular that you would be looking for in the due diligence process for a company like this?
Yeah, I'd want to be checking policies. I'd want to be checking, I want to see that Ofsted report, which you can obviously do publicly. When were they last assessed? If that goes back, because there was a backlog period around COVID where, you know, educational establishments just weren't assessed and they just got to keep their accreditation, their level of award for longer. And so if they still haven't been around for another cycle, how can I be sure that this is still a good nursery, for example? So if that was recent, I'd have more confidence. Not that anybody really wants to ever invite an Ofsted inspection, but you would probably want one to have been done in the recent past is really what I'm saying. I'd want to see, obviously, employment contracts, tenure, length of service, org charts, those kind of things. Insurances, accreditations to any of the particular like large groups, by which I mean like the industry associations, training records, those kind of things. It's a human-centric business, isn't it? You know, these are tiny humans who are in the hands of the bigger, more experienced humans, and they're the ones that, you know, can give you a liability or otherwise. But I'd like to look at some of the record keeping, you know, maybe accident logs, because they'll all be keeping some higher-level metrics around amount of accidents. Those kind of things, in addition to the kind of quality of earnings, what do they do by way of payments? Do they charge people, you know, X number of months up front, or is it all just monthly in arrears? Like, what is their kind of invoicing policy? That's pretty standard fare. There's some simple due diligence you could probably do with businesses like this, but I think the trick is not to rock the boat too much, because they're obviously doing well doing what they do. You want to keep them functioning optimal and use that as a platform, I think, to build on.
I totally agree. I think the only thing I would add to that is I would want to, I mean, you do this by course anyway, but a real solid sort of property appraisal of those three locations, because if there is any, you know, deferred maintenance or anything to be done, like you said, you are entrusted in the care of these little humans. And I think that this is a super important thing to look into. So,
to that end, do you want the property? Like, there's another thing here. Like, could you carve out the opcos here and just buy the cash generating assets, have the owner keep the property in their pension fund or in their propco, and charge us a rent, you know, give us a renewed lease for the next 10 years or something on each of the sites, and then at least we've got an opex that is, you know, part of the cost of, you know, part of the overheads in serving this day-to-day revenue, without necessarily having all the capital obligations that you have as being a landlord as well. So I wonder if there's a deal that's more affordably to be done if someone didn't want to take on a commercial mortgage, and to just buy the opco piece.
Mm. Okay.
So I guess we've got to get to decision time, really, Alfie. If it were your money, what would you do?
So we get to buy or pass. This is an interesting one. So in a hypothetical, if I knew what I was doing with nurseries, I think it's one that I would look into. I think I'd go for buy. I think it's in a really great location. I think there are some possibilities for expansion, maybe. I think the area is on the up, lots of new houses being built. I really like the idea of the SaaS model training the next leadership baby. So if I knew what I was doing, I think I'd go buy for this one. How about you?
Well, I have a list to never work with animals, universities, or children. I might be having to break my own rules if I went down this road. But I'm in split minds. I kind of like the profitability. I kind of like it's just at that sort of size where you could throw some more on there and build it out into a little group and start using it as a platform to go and do some more tuck-ins and you know, be a mini Grandeer or a mini Busy Bees or whatever. Yeah. I do look enviously at some of these roll-ups and think, yeah, there's some decent returns there. So I'd probably support you. I would vote for it.
Wow. Well, there we go. It's our first unified vote. We're going to buy the nursery in Manchester. Yeah, first consensus. That's the word I was grasping for and missing. Consensus. Yeah, excellent. Oh, awesome. Well, anybody listening, please let us know what you think. We'd love to know if you would buy or pass on this. And if you are somebody that's looking for a nursery, then let us know. Maybe we can help put you in touch.
Yeah, excellent. Absolutely.
So
cool. We have an interview next week with another a successful searcher that's got a couple of deals done in recent months. So very much looking forward to that. We continue to put the finishing touches to the symposium. Love to get more folks aware of that. And the tickets are still available. That's on the 18th of June, taking place in central London. Visit serialacquirer.uk for your day pass. We've added a couple of sponsors recently, so it's looking like a decent event. What else?
Always keep up to date with new features coming out on BizCrunch. Obviously, recently we launched our outreach, so we are the first platform to allow you to go end-to-end to find an outreach to customers on the platform. We've got some more exciting features coming out very soon, so stay tuned for all of that too.
Magic. Yeah, exactly. So, exciting period ahead. Thanks everyone for listening. Love to hear your comments and thoughts on this deal below, and we'll see you next week. Until then, keep on crunching.
Keep on crunching.